Case number 6 is United States v. Padilla. Mr. O'Reilly.
Good morning, Your Honors. In reviewing this case for oral argument, I realized that I made quite an error, and I want to bring it to the Court's attention because I think that the error has a serious impact on the case. I overlooked what was a very small part of the trial, but I think that it has very important ramifications for my argument on sufficiency of the evidence. Right at the beginning of the trial, there was an Officer Schneider who testified on direct examination. It's at page 12 of the brief. Officer Schneider testified that Garcia, who was the confidential informant, and the defendant, Jose Padilla, made arrangements for a drug purchase. Trial counsel objected on the grounds of hearsay and requested to approach the court. The court denied that and overruled the objection, saying, well, in isolation, the question is somewhat of a problem, but I think probably in context it doesn't, so I will overrule the objection at this point. In my review of the record in preparation for oral argument, that is the only evidence of knowledge that I could find, and I did not raise in my principal brief or in the reply brief that the denial of that, the overruling of the objection, was appellate error. When I look at the record, clearly that was the only place in the entire record that I could find where that evidence was elicited. There was no foundation. It appears to be hearsay. Neither of the participants to that conversation testified. It's obviously crucial to the case and certainly affects the analysis that we went through. We were obviously, both the government and I were very focused on the sequence of events involving the drug transaction. The only evidence, however, that shows that my client had any knowledge is this statement, which is without any sort of time frame. It's not clear how the officer came to know this information, whether he was told it by the confidential informant or anything like that. You know, unfortunately, I mean, the error is mine. It's ineffective assistance of counsel. And, you know, I discovered it literally within the last 12 hours. I mean, I obviously read it and just didn't appreciate the significance. I was really looking at this as who was the principal party involved rather than looking at the aiding and abetting knowledge when I wrote the briefs. So the problem is mine. Putting that aside...
But putting that to one side, I guess my question for you had been, why can it not be, I guess I'll almost call it body language, you know, from the sequence of observable actions that Mr. Padilla took in conjunction with this whole transaction, why cannot one infer that he isn't just some innocent, you know, who happens to be hanging out with the wrong people, but that in fact he is in critical places, you know, taking visible actions throughout this transaction?
Well, actually, I mean, I'm not sure that there is such a thing as body language in this case that would lead a jury to conclude that all the elements could be met. Certainly, beyond what I've identified, there's no evidence of knowledge. There's only one discussion.
There's no direct evidence, but I'm just saying if he's with Garcia, he's driving his car to the right place, he's doing all of these things, I mean, at what point would an inference of knowledge from the circumstantial evidence be appropriate?
Well, I think that you would have to have a situation in which he would have to witness the drugs being transferred. That would certainly be evidence of knowledge. I think that he would have to have some sort of a direct link to this. It's certainly a situation where I think it's a coin toss. It's just as possible that he didn't know, or it's possible that that it was mere presence. I mean, that's one of the things that the cases always say. You have a situation here where you could have mere presence. That's why we cited Jones, United States versus Jones, because that was a similar case in which it's not at all clear what's happening. I think the other thing that's very important is that we're talking about proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And the government asks, what's the innocent explanation? And I don't think that that's an appropriate question. My client doesn't have a burden of proof. My client doesn't have to come forward and say, well, I was discussing lottery tickets with him when the word money came up. He doesn't have to explain why he went into the store for 10 minutes or 5 minutes and was shopping after the supposed drug transaction. He doesn't have to proffer any evidence. It's the government's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And when you look at this evidence, you're at best at a coin toss. You're in a situation where, sure, there's some suspicious activity here, absolutely. But can you take that driving, having a discussion with someone who he may or may not have known, picking up a friend, giving a friend a ride?
Well, in the midst of a transaction that the government does seem to have identified as a sale of drugs, sale of methamphetamine, right? I mean, the money's there, the drugs change hands. I mean, they proved that. I thought it was Mr. Padilla's role that was...
Well, they proved that a transaction occurred.
Right, and Mr. Padilla's right in the middle of it, I guess.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure how you can say he's right in the middle of it. The transaction could most likely did take place when he wasn't in the car, when he was in a separate car, without his presence. There's nothing that links him to the knowledge, with the exception of this Officer Schneider's testimony. There's really nothing there. It's a situation where there's just as easily an innocent explanation as there isn't. Why couldn't it be mere presence? I mean, what is the fact that distinguishes this case from mere presence? Now, I've handled other cases involving controlled buys where the defendant is the only person who meets with the confidential informant. And there, you know, it makes me think of res ipsa loquitur, the negligence theory. Who else could it be? But here, we have a different individual who met with him alone in the car. It raises reasonable doubt. It has to raise reasonable doubt. And the idea that they can, instead of proving the link, I mean, they didn't find any buy money, they've got no physical evidence, they've got no tape recordings, they don't have any sort of evidence that would link Mr. Padilla directly to it. And yet, he's the only one being prosecuted. They didn't find any of the marked money. They didn't find any of the any link between Mr. Padilla and the drugs. So it seems to me it's a situation where there's simply not enough evidence. And of course, it's a situation where the confidential informant passed away. If the confidential informant hadn't died before trial, I'm sure, you know, the confidential informant could have testified. And, you know, his testimony would have been very interesting. But we don't have that. And, you know, from that situation, it's simply... there's a lack of proof. There's a lack of evidence. And certainly Judge Sharp saw the same thing. And I have to say, I was really surprised. Judge Sharp clearly indicated that he wanted a motion for judgment of acquittal after trial, saying, I expect to revisit this issue. It was never filed. You know, there was never any arguments, any case law presented to Judge Sharp on this particular issue. I think if there was, he might have had a different result. But this court we've cited the cases. You're certainly able to take a look at the record. It seems to me that this evidence is extraordinarily thin. There's very little.
Rebuttal time, if you'd like to save just a bit. And Mr. Holland.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. The video surveillance and the officer testimony in this case did provide sufficient evidence for the jury to convict the defendant of aiding in the distribution of methamphetamine. There was, I think, as you pointed out, Judge Wood, through the body language of the defendant and through his close actions linking him to the other unidentified Hispanic male, a reasonable jury could draw inferences in favor of the government without engaging in the kind of wild speculation that was faulted in the cases that were cited in the defense brief in order to find beyond a reasonable doubt that this defendant was involved in the drug transaction.
What did he do to aid it?
Yeah.
He's involved in meeting Mr. Garcia at one market, meeting him at another location, essentially directing him where to go. He's involved in meeting the other gentleman at his house. He drives him part of the way, a block or two. They then walk and meet in different locations. They meet, and there's a discussion about money. He moves from one location where he can't observe what's going on in the front of the market to another location where he can. He picks up the informant. They walk into the store, and there are other exchanges that go on, and they leave together. They're clearly involved in aiding and working together and taking steps that the jury could reasonably infer are engaged in surveillance, are engaged in counter-surveillance. There was testimony.
Where the evidence then? Ordinarily, I understand that ordinarily when you commit an offense like this, when someone commits an offense like this, they either do it by themselves or they do it with somebody. And if somebody is along, probably are, they're probably involved. But you need a little more evidence than that, other than the mere presence of somebody at the scene of a transaction like this.
Absolutely, but there was...
That person usually is there for protection, to be a lookout, to...
Right,
to
but
help
if you,
you
what
some way. I'm just curious about what actually the evidence shows.
The evidence in the
record.
Other
than speculating that.
I don't think that that's true, Your Honor. I think the evidence in the record shows that the defendant was moving from location to location. He's watching what's going on. He's not an innocent bystander. He's not merely present.
It's so terrible to move from location to location. What is it about that that then takes the next step, other than he's just keeping somebody company? How do we know? What piece of evidence sort of puts it over the line?
All of the actions of the defendant, Your Honor, are being done to set up a drug transaction. The drug transaction never would have occurred if the meeting hadn't occurred at Cuero-Mero Market. The meeting at Cuero-Mero Market only occurs because, I mean, that's where the drug transaction takes place. If it doesn't take place there, it takes place at Los Galanes, which is, and only the defendant and Mr. Padilla, or defendant and Mr. Garcia are there. So then we have no problem. So the only other possible place where this drug transaction could have occurred is when the unknown individual meets with Mr. Garcia. Mr. Garcia clearly goes there because the deal is set at Los Galanes Market, according to Mr. Schneider. They are there, and they then move to another location. Mr. Garcia goes to the other location. The other individual is brought to that location by Mr. Padilla. He picks him up at a house. They do something that can't be seen from 1,500 feet in the air at a trunk, and they then bring him partway. I mean, I understand that the government has the burden, but at the same time, if one can't even come up with a reasonable explanation for why someone would go to a house, pick someone up and drive them one block, and then let them out and drive to another location when both of them are meeting the same individual, it's reasonable for a jury to infer that that's because they are both aiding and involved in distributing the drugs.
Well, it's certainly enough that the jury might think something fishy is happening, but aiding and abetting law has specific requirements.
And the jury was instructed that they have to take steps to further the drug transaction. Bringing someone to the scene of a drug transaction furthers the drug transaction. And it's reasonable based on everything that's going on. Mr. Garcia or Mr. Padilla, after he meets at Los Galanes, there's a description from the officer in the air that he doesn't just drive straight to the third person's house. He backs into a driveway. He makes several circuitous turns. He's going through all of these actions and activities, which means he clearly knows that he's involved in illegal activity. Nobody who's involved innocently, merely present, is going through all of these routes. Nobody who's merely innocently present is purposely trying to separate themselves from the other individual. You either go separately to a location or you go together. You don't go partway and then you drive in from one side and the third person walks from a different location. Why is that being done? That's being done to not because... In the Jones case, you're hanging around the gun store with somebody who's committing an illegal act, but because you're purposely trying to surveil a drug transaction without other people being involved. I mean, Your Honors, you've all been on the bench a long time. You've seen these DEA drug cases all the time. And in the Parra case, for example, Mr. Arturo Parra is set at one location. He comes from a different direction from the car in the white Cadillac. He's sitting there. He's surveilling what's going on. And the court found sufficient evidence there. And there really is very little different in those cases. Again here, there's a brief conversation. Mr. Garcia again comes to the car at Cuero-Mero. There's a meeting. There's a discussion about money. The $3,500 is given to Mr. Garcia. He starts with it. He doesn't end with it. And then there's something immediately after that meeting. What happens? The only way that under this theory he could possibly be innocent is if something is going on when the third unknown man and Mr. Garcia meet, and that Mr. Padilla hasn't done anything to further that and doesn't know what's going on. And that's not what happens here. It's clear.
The question is the evidence you have enough to permit a jury to find your theory beyond a reasonable doubt?
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Preponderance kind of standard.
I think, though, again, when one looks at this, I mean, I think it would be a strange world we live in, honestly, Your Honor, where putting, I mean, we have historical cases all the time where a witness stands under oath and says, this guy sold me crack cocaine 12 years ago and I have no other evidence of it. And we uphold those things all the time. We do. Whatever they said under oath is acceptable. There's no doubt. There's no doubt that this is a drug deal. There's no doubt. The jury watched the video a second time, and they then took an hour to convict. Reasonable people can look at this and say, it's clear this man is not merely present at the drug transaction. It's clear that he's not just hanging around. It's clear that he's involved from the get-go. He's the one who meets with Mr. Garcia. He's the one who meets with the third guy. He then meets again with Mr. Garcia, having come separately from the third guy. Mr. Garcia goes and spends a matter of moments with the third guy. Let's assume the transaction occurs then. Immediately after that, as soon as Mr. Garcia is out of the scene, Mr. Padilla gets out of the car, meets with the third guy, and they go into the market together. They then leave. They go to a Taco Bell. They go to the mall. They spend, as far as we know, a significant period of time together. To say that a jury, the jury, I mean, this is in par as well. A jury is entitled to make reasonable inferences, to decide whether this is counter-surveillance or whether this is mere presence. The jury can look at this. It's a high standard. It's a high burden. The death of the confidential informant was obviously very difficult for us. We had several other cases indicted with this individual. We dismissed two or three of the other ones and only proceeded on two.
See, to me, the strongest evidence you have is this overhearing him say money. One of the agents overheard him say money.
Well, that's true as well, because
that's something to hang your hat on here.
Because otherwise,
but
one has
here,
to.
When you got a thin case like this, and Judge Sharp, it looked like he was pretty close to kicking it when the government rested. So it's a pretty thin case, close case. He lets it go to the jury, but then the jury had also heard this introductory testimony about from the detective. Why were you there? Well, we were there because Padilla and Garcia were going to do a drug deal. I know that wasn't admitted for the truth of it, but yet the jury hears that. That's pretty powerful evidence. And juries, I don't think, pay much attention to these kind of cautionary instructions, although we like to think they do.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, but even if that once, I mean, I agree that the money statement is very strong evidence because the money transfers hands too. So the money, you know, and the money is transferred. I mean, look, we all know the money's transferred in Mr. Padilla's car. And then once that's done, that's the signal, that's the go-ahead, now you can go get the drugs, and this is all being done. It's done in a two-stage manner so that if necessary, they can. Nobody ever has both the money and the drugs on them at the same time. There's plausible deniability. This is why this is done in that fashion. But the mention of money, now one has to assume that there's some other conversation, there's some other mention of money that's going on here, and immediately thereafter, there's money and drugs going on here. One can always assume. I mean, there's doubt in every case. One can always construct some sort of theory in the most ironclad case, but that's what we have juries for, is to look at this, to look at the evidence. They were instructed beyond a reasonable doubt that they had to make this finding. They looked at the evidence. They heard money. They saw the tape. They saw and heard the video of where everyone was going, and I believe that it is a close case, but it was enough to get over the beyond a reasonable doubt line. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. O'Reilly.
Well, I mean, certainly the government and the defendants all agree that there's certainly some suspicious activity. I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, it's all perfectly innocent. But it also strikes me as a situation where if clever theories want to be spun out to explain the actions for which no explanation is really necessary, it's not hard. I mean, the last weekend I was having brake problems on my Subaru, and you should have seen the route that I took around the neighborhood trying to figure out what was wrong with my brakes. I mean, I would have looked like I was engaging in counter-surveillance. And, in fact, they tried to elicit an opinion from the person who was actually in the airplane that it was counter-surveillance, and the judge said, well, this is just too speculative. You know, you're up there, and the judge refused to entertain that opinion. I really think that there's inference upon inference is being piled up in this case. For example, in the government's view, it's Mr. Garcia who's directing where people are going to meet. But there's no evidence in that record. It could be, it's entirely possible and even likely, that the reason why Mr. Garcia wasn't in the car when the man in the yellow hat met with Mr. Garcia was because the man in the yellow hat didn't want Padilla involved, because Mr. Padilla didn't know what was going on. Mr. Padilla had scant involvement. Mr. Padilla was blind, and that's why you'd exclude him. And, of course, perhaps Mr. Padilla got suspicious and he moved the car. These are all plausible plausible scenarios. I mean, it's for that sort of thing. I mean, they could have been, you know, with the discussion of money, it's not a discussion of drugs. I mean, money is particularly innocuous. Not only that, the conversation was in Spanish, and all he picked up was one English word. It's impossible to know if the word money, I mean, money may have been stated, and I'm certainly willing to view the facts in the light most favorable to the government, but it seems to me that it's an awfully slender reed to hang a criminal conviction for drug distribution on someone picking up the word money in a conversation in which he couldn't understand it. I think that concludes my time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. You were appointed, were you not, Mr.
Yes, I was.
We thank you for your service, for your client, and to the court. Thanks also to the government. We will take the case under advisement.